Okay, welcome everybody. Good to have you here. Day today is dedicated to exploring right livelihood, and I'll just sort of throw myself in, really. I'd say when I first when we were talking about the using this as a topic, we thought, well, that's great. We haven't done that before. And then started thinking, what the heck are we going to do anyway? but then I thought, well, there's definitely going to be lots of discussion, so we don't have to worry about it. Then I started actually researching. I said, we've got all sorts of ideas, and you're gonna probably have to turn me off at some point. Turn the switch and say, okay, time to move into discussion. There's lots of, to me, it was lots of really interesting things, because the I think particularly in the West, the emphasis is so heavily on meditation that many of the social aspects of Buddhism and Buddhist worldview, Buddhist application of the principles of the teachings of the Buddha don't get highlighted very much. So I think it's a great opportunity to explore that. And I wanted to begin just a couple short readings. I'll do a bunch of short readings, and I'll probably go for about half an hour, and then open it up to discussion. The first book that I want to read from is a. I'll do a couple of short quotes, but if anybody's interested to track this down, Buddhist Economics, Proper Yuto, it's a very good. It's written in early 1990s, and it's from a talk that this monk was gave at. I think at a the faculty of economics at a big university, and then then it was put into a book, and it's probably 3-4 hour talk, it just outlines the Buddhist perspective on economics and living in the world. For this specific application of livelihood, this I think this gives a bit of an overview. Contrary to the misconception that Buddhism is only for renunciants, Buddhists recognize that acquiring wealth is one of life's fundamental activities, and the Buddha gave many teachings on the proper way to acquire wealth. But he also stressed that the purpose of wealth is to facilitate the development of highest human potential. In Buddhism, there are said to be three goals in life: the initial, medium, and ultimate goals. The initial goal is reasonable material comfort and economic security. Material security, however, is only a foundation for the two higher, more abstract goals, mental well-being and inner freedom. The major part of our lives is taken up with economic activities. If economics is to have any real part to play in the resolution of human problems, then all economic activities, production, consumption, work, and spending, must contribute to well-being and help realize the potential for a good and noble life. It is something that we are capable of doing. The essence of Buddhist economics lies here, in ensuring that economic activity enhances the quality of our lives. That's a sort of set that as a baseline. That's useful for plugging back into and recognizing where many of the actual teachings, where they're going, what the ethos is for that. On the actual, there's a little section, very short, on right livelihood. Right livelihood is one factor on the Noble Eightfold Path. It is not determined by the amount of material wealth it produces, but rather by the well-being it generates. Many livelihoods which produce a surplus of wealth simply cater to desires rather than providing for any true need. For the individual, the objective of livelihood is to acquire the four necessities or requisites of human existence: food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. Again, the acquisition of these four requisites, be it in sufficient amount or in surplus, is not the ultimate objective. The four requisites are merely a foundation upon which efforts to realize higher objectives can be based. Some people are content with few possessions and need only a minimum to devote their energies to mental and spiritual development. Others cannot live happily on such a small amount. They are more dependent on material goods. As long as their livelihood does not exploit others, however, Buddhism does not condemn their wealth. Moreover, people who are charitably inclined can use their wealth in ways that are beneficial for society as a whole. In opposition to contemporary urban values, Buddhism does not measure a person's or a nation's worth by material wealth. Nor does it go to the opposite extreme, as do Marxist thinkers, and condemn the accumulation of wealth as an evil in and of itself. Instead, Buddhism judges the ethical value of wealth by the ways in which it is obtained and the uses to which it is put. I think that's a really good reflection in terms of the not so much the external application or what one's doing, and that it immediately has a label of right or wrong, but that the degree of ethic or the degree to which ethics and moral principles are applied the obtaining and then what it's being put to use for. There, I also came across this little in the Buddhist teachings, he tends to condemn might be a bit strong, but certainly censure. Being miserly or stingy, and there's so that generosity is a very high value, and so that in the there's a Jataka story where a miserly person is likened to a bird called the Maihaka bird. It lives in a fig tree. Fig trees have actually lots of fruit, and while all the other birds flock to the tree and eat its fruit, the Maihaka bird, what he does is stand there calling out, "Maihang, Maihang," which in Pali means "mine, mine." So this is one of these precious little gems of stories that are sprinkled through the suttas. That sense of, but it's also interesting. It was just yesterday I saw this article referencing Warren Buffett as speaking out against the kind of speculation in gold, in that saying that that's one of the he really spoke strongly against the accumulation of gold because it was just it doesn't perform a useful function within a society. All it is accumulation of a symbol of wealth, which one can then hang on to and not actually utilize. So I thought it was interesting. So the Warren Buffett, one of the wealthiest people in America, using that. Because that's, I don't know what gold is these days, but it's a lot. There's a lot of speculation.
It's been nose diving, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's like
Well, again, it's a good sort of thing. Because it has no intrinsic value. So any questions on that? It's the readings that we sent out. I think there's some, again, there wasn't a huge amount, but which people might have been relieved to not get those long lists of readings that one needed to do. I think very specifically in terms of wrong livelihood, the Buddha pointed to, say, the types of business that dealing in weapons, dealing in human beings, dealing in meat and slaughter or taking of life, dealing in intoxicants and dealing in poisons. Those are the Buddha censured those as wrong livelihood for somebody who is following a Buddhist path. As a layperson, and then there's kind of a long list for the monastics, but it's mostly around kind of astrology and fortune telling and stuff like that, spells,
lottery numbers,
yeah, absolutely. Those are, there's a huge, in Thailand, I mean, it's a huge livelihood is gained by the people flock to the monasteries the day before the lottery numbers come out.
So is the problem that the monks have the numbers?
Because
they're giving out the right numbers, everyone's flocking?
Well, that's the thing, who knows? Because it's when they you never, it's like the people who don't get it, they just sort of try again. Anyway, the Buddha censured it 2,500 years ago. It looks bad even today.
Could you just talk a little bit more about those particular professions that the Buddha laid out as wrong livelihoods? I was thinking about that. So why would he not say this other ones, like say being in the military something like this? I'm just curious to know if there were certain principles.
One of the things that is important to recognize that the Buddha tends to be very precise in his so that if he's forbidden a livelihood, it'll be because it's intrinsically harmful or intrinsically conducive to unwholesome karma. So something like the military, it really depends on the attitude. It depends on the actual application of it, one's duties that one ends up doing, so that it's not intrinsically wrong. It's not sort of if you engage in it that there's definitely going to be unwholesome karma. Doesn't mean that it's good karma, but it isn't intrinsic. So that, but these, the Buddha is, I think pretty clear that these would intrinsically be conducive to unwholesome karma. Dealing in weapons directly involved in the promoting of violence or taking of life. So there's a very direct relationship. Human beings, in terms of whether it's slave trade or maybe, prostitution. Those are ways, and particularly in terms of, I would think in somebody who is controlling or as a business. And then, of course, in meat is involved in the slaughter and sale of meat, directly taking life. Intoxicants. Promotes a lot of heedlessness within a culture, dependency. Those are things, and then in poisons that again, which are something that is immediately detrimental to somebody's health. So those are you're looking at those principles underneath it and recognize, okay, that's really harmful. It's helpful to in terms of making decisions. I mean, these are all things that are common within a society, ordinary, but then just because it's ordinary and common doesn't mean that one should be engaging in them if one's looking to establish a livelihood, and even if it's again that sort of that the economic value is one could maybe make a lot of money, but then is it actually right livelihood that promotes wholesome karma in this lifetime, and then of course leading to subsequent lives. There's a person who I know. When her husband died, she reviewed. Her husband was very wealthy. When he died, she was still pretty young and hadn't been at all involved in the... She'd probably 30... maybe 30 or 32, and had several children at that time. She'd be about 32. So quite young, and then she had several children, and then her husband just died, and then she starts kind of reviewing the portfolio of what her husband owns and realizes that one of the things that he owns is the company Singha Beer in Thailand, which is, it's a big company. It's popular. She just get rid of that. I don't want that in to be making money from that. It's really quite, because a lot, sort of economically, it was a big hit. But there wasn't a doubt for her that had to be, just couldn't do that.
So would you say, just since here we are in Mendocino County, on our very own block.
Yes.
Lotteries.
Oh, yes.
And medical marijuana, which is not necessarily intended as a intoxicant person.
Yeah.
But would be, said, you know, would it be said then that growing grapes in the vineyard, that's not a great life?
I would question it. Because it's specifically for wine. It's specifically as an intoxicant. That's also why I say, like, we go alms round on Redwood Valley Road, walking down Redwood Valley Road, and we're invited to the Fry Vineyards, and it's a very well established vineyard. And correct me if I'm wrong, Pamela. But Daniel, Daniel invited us to go alms round. He's one of the Fry family, and he looks after goats, and he does sort of other things in the garden, looks after the garden, but he won't be involved in the production of the grapes and the wine production. He just looks at that's not right likelihood. And is it, huh? Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And you know, he's got. I mean, it's a huge family. I mean, 12 kids, and then I don't know how many grandchildren. It's who can count them. But you know, it's a big family, and most of them are still around there. So it's a. You know, as a business and as a family thing, it's kind of exemplary, but it's not very good livelihood. And you know, Daniel makes that decision to live on the edges of his kind of the family business.
Can you speak about then the people who sell these things versus who make them?
Yeah, I mean, I would say selling it is, you know, it's pretty much the same. Which it's hard for people. So, I mean, I get asked this all the time. Restaurant owners, and if you've got a restaurant in the city, and it's, you know. If it's kind of mom and pop thing, then you know, a little thing, then you know, you don't need to, you know, as a restaurant business, you don't need to, or it's not. But if you're, you know, think of a bit larger restaurant, you want it to be popular, it ends up you're providing alcohol as well. So, yeah, I mean, different people deal with it in different ways.
Well, I remember a similar situation many years ago that somebody called on the phone and actually was a clerk at the cash register in an organic food store. And he'd been working there for a number of years.
Right.
The owner started, after he had been employed there, he decided to start selling alcohol there, like wine.
Right. What do I do?
If I quit this job, I've got a family to support. You know, I don't have any other skills. I don't know how long it would be for me before I could find another job that would give me enough to support my family. Is this wrong livelihood? Am I doing something wrong by passing, taking these people's money for a while?
Right.
So sometimes it's not always cut and dried.
It's not cut and dried, because that's. Yeah, I mean, he's there. I mean, it's a whole different intention. So that there's... I mean, and that's one of the things once you start reflecting on right and wrong livelihood. And, you know, we love to have it, you know, black and white and absolutely nailed down. There are lots of nuances. It's helpful to, it's helpful to have these to reflect on, and in making decisions and in recognizing. But you know, one of the things one always comes back to is the karma. The essence of karma is volition or intention. So that, you know, in the sense of this person being a clerk in a store that's already, you know, had one mission as it was, and then it's probably a fairly small portion of the actual volume of sales. That's very different than getting out there and investing large amounts of money in creating an intoxicant which you can sell at high prices. The reality is people enjoy a lot of things that aren't actually good. Like some people enjoy killing, some people enjoy sort of stealing from other people. So that's enjoyment. It's not necessarily a good standard to take for making decisions. And then one has to always sort of look at result as well, the effect that it has, and the purpose that the Buddha has a prescription against intoxicants is because of the increased likelihood of heedlessness that comes from that. And it really doesn't take much researching of statistics to recognize one majority of traffic accidents, yeah, there's some intoxicants. Majority of crimes, actually, you go to any kind of prison or jail, and the vast majority of people that are there, oftentimes they can't even quite remember what it was that they're there for because they were, drunk or stoned at the time. So it's there is an effect. In terms of that increasing of heedlessness, even if you enjoy it. Of course, that's the whole point of the exercise. Yes. Yeah, well, I mean, that's the oftentimes that's even more worrisome, in the sense of the because delusion is a stronger factor than is a more destructive factor than say greed and just doing it just to because you want to make a profit, but the kind of the conviction of when something is actually really wrong, and then that conviction of its rightness is even more worrisome because of the kind of delusion and ignorance behind it.
Yeah. Just a thought, because it does seem like there's, keep in mind, like you said, we like to have it black and white. And this very much, like, say, unwholesome livelihood kind of falls on a spectrum.
Yeah.
So, like, I think of an example. If the way that you judge the degree of the wrong livelihood is the result, is in the sense of, does it increase unwholesome states?
Mm-hmm.
And you just think of something, say, like serving alcohol at a restaurant where it's like a family restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
It would seem to me that, okay, it might technically fall under the category, but it does seem like, say, vastly different from, say, like a pub, where like the whole purpose of the pub, its very existence, is to get people drunk, basically.
Yeah.
And that's what happens. Whereas at a restaurant, you basically, you know, let's say for, you know, I guess it depends on the restaurant, but you might recognize that, you know, very few people really, if anybody really gets really drunk.
Yeah.
But still, I was just kind of recognizing these kind of little nuances. And,
oh, yeah, totally. Yeah.
And,
No, there's, there really is a spectrum, and, it's important. I think that's if there is a kind of a takeaway for the day, is that they, you know, paying attention, or the actual application of the Buddhist teaching is really being able to reflect and understand of is the result of any particular action, does it increase unwholesome mental states, or does it decrease unwholesome mental states? And that's much more of and whether it's for personally or for others, that's one of the most important factors to recognize. Oh, I wouldn't even go there. Well, I think one of the things of, you know, especially with caffeinated beverages, there's we're looking at a spectrum, so that you know, what is a normal sort of, pick me up energizer. And doesn't really impair judgment or health really on any way, then that's really not a problem at all. But there can be for the most part, like in monasteries, tea, coffee, that's very ordinary. And then people will make individual choices. Yeah, Dan.
I was just along the lines of talking about the spectrum and the sort of degree of intention and the sort of karmic results that follow. Just thinking about like meat eating, you know, or like thinking about there's like the person who raises the animal and sells it in the slaughterhouse, and then the restaurant. Thinking about, because the people often, like, I don't eat a lot of meat, but I do sometimes eat meat, and you know, people who I know who say, well, that's not very sadistic, and I think, well, that's right, it's not, but it's sort of, I think of it as a spectrum, and sort of working with the craving for things like meat. Possible, but I guess it's sort of along that same line. It's like it's not really.
It's not totally black and white, and then you start looking again. It sort of comes into intention and volition, and it's like just the fact of having a human existence. You impact other beings. How many insects were slaughtered today for people coming up to a Bayagiri day to listen to the teachings? It happens.
It's like an interesting, it's sort of a paradox in a
way, yeah.
Because I really do feel like, to be honest about it, for me personally, I feel like I have to acknowledge, yeah, there is kind of harm in that. And yet, it's sort of hard to be, and I think sort of perfection is something to aspire to, but it's also sort of impossible at the same time.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So that sense, and different people will, when you have a spectrum, then different people can be land on different places of that spectrum. But the main thing is that people are willing to reflect and take responsibility for their actions, and that's an important piece of the puzzle, because it is. Again, it's similar to the example that Prabhupada gives in this, in the sense different people will be comfortable at different degrees of contentment and ability to live simply. And so and it's not, the goal is not a total elimination of consumption, but being able to be clear and responsible within that.
And Prabhupada Yuto is talking about the production and the consumption, like both sides of the economic exchange.
Yeah.
So I wonder, the Buddha said, okay, these five livelihoods are wrong livelihood. That's kind of from the producer side, like you shouldn't produce and talk to. Is there any similar teaching about, also good to not be the consumer, because then you're part of that transaction happening. Right. So obviously, if there's no demand for guns or intoxicants or meat or whatever, then there's going to be not an economic incentive for people to have those jobs.
This is true, but the Buddha doesn't go to an ideal level. So in an ideal world, that would be how it works. But the Buddha didn't give the teachings to create an ideal world. He gave the teachings in order to live within a world that wasn't ideal, and to be able to make those kind of choices and decisions that help us to weave our way through it all, and that. Because certainly in the Buddha's time, then he himself was from a warrior caste, so he knew a lot about weapons, and the reality is that there are these things happening in the world, and it's sort of how do you adjust to that or adapt to that, and not be overwhelmed by it, not be deluded by it, but also to be able to make skillful choices within that.
What's the view on some medical professions or pharmaceutical that produces drugs?
Yeah, they produce poisons. That's true. Yeah, but it's also, again, it's what its application is, and how it's used. Things like some actual drugs are, directly poisonous, but then they have a medical application, which is useful. And it's not, again, it's not black and white, or the where there's a particular. Well, even to say drugs which are used as painkillers, whether they're morphine based or they're codeine based, they're very helpful for certain circumstances, and used recreationally, then they have a different effect.
What about things that that have an ostensibly benign purpose, such as pesticides and fertilizers for raising food, but that in fact have actually quite harmful effects?
Oh yeah, you can get me going on that. No, I mean, think in terms, you know, just the companies that are producing, let's say, like Roundup is a good example, and then different crops that are then made that are resistant. So they're actually genetically modified so that you have to use their product.
And
they have a huge effect on land and water. So, those are... there's an incredible amount of research that goes into it. And it's a very lucrative... product, but working for what the heck's the name of that big
Monsanto?
Yeah, Monsanto. I have a that's got to be the kind of the evil corporation.
So then the choice to eat may not be black and white, to eat like locally sustainably raised meat.
Mm-hmm.
Versus industrially farmed soybeans or something.
Yeah.
It may not be clear.
It may not be at all clear. Yeah. And in particular nowadays, where you can't even, in America in particular, where things, the lobby is so strong that you can't even, it's not labeled, so you can't actually make a decision. So there, yeah.
Maybe on a subtler levels, people who have to make decisions, for example, at pharmaceuticals to say they'll research one disease because that will make money.
Yeah.
We're not going to look at these others because there's no money in that. So is there any instruction from the Buddha of how to...
I don't think the Buddha, even the Buddha, could have conceived how diabolical that was. No, I know what you're talking about.
Some people, want to help, and they get in situations and realize, there are a lot of sick people, and we're only going to research what we can make money on. What would be how to protect your
Well, I think this is where where you end up making an individual choice in when you're if you end up in a company and you actually you go to school, you go to grad school, you get your degrees, and you have this idealistic hope of being able to do medical research, and it's really wonderful, and then you get stuck doing it where you're just channeled into that and you have no option. I mean, that's it's kind of soul destroying. so sometimes you make choices maybe it'd be get a lower paying job at something that's more satisfying, rather than participating in that kind of an ethos.
So it would come down to really how it was affecting you.
I mean, one is you're recognizing the effect that it has externally, and but you make a choice of paying attention to how it affects you personally and say, no, but, I'd rather put my time and energy. Because it is, you live in the world and as Prabhupada said, you do it in order to have the means for providing the four requisites. And once those, but you also have to live it every day. And that choice is affecting your well-being or your lack of well-being. So that you want to put looking for some other way. I think of, on a certain extreme example is Karuniko. Went to school, was a really sharp engineering student, and got this really good job with engineering technology, sort of cutting edge technology. But it was used for arms industry and missile guidance systems, and that was what it. So I said, I don't think I can do this anymore. He's a monk now. But that was what got him really thinking. Was, this is wrong. Having all this. I have this knowledge and this skill, and then this is what it's being used for.
Yeah, that just points out very clearly that the fact that this path, and trying to fulfill the goals of the path, it's not easy. The giving up of the things that we are used to, having to give up some material gain or some. Something that's a comfort is always hard, but that's what this path is involved with. It's sort of like you have to let go of something before you can actually realize the benefits of it sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it's a real stretch to say, okay, well, maybe I have to change my job, or maybe I have to move on, and there's going to be some difficulty with that. I'm going to have to give up something that's going to feel painful. But then what you get by having done that, is a whole different level of peace of mind. You didn't really realize you were missing until you actually do it.
Yeah, and that's another aspect of it is it isn't as if there's an intrinsic value in making yourself miserable by trying to find the most perfect job, but when you realize also that when you take some care and some thought into it, and then there's going to be some real satisfaction involved, and oftentimes if you're happier, you're going to be. And it doesn't necessarily even mean that there's an economic problem to it. It's oftentimes we just our box is so sort of prescribed and limited that we limit ourselves. Actually, there's other ways that I can be doing this, I'm actually better off, and not just. Emotionally, but even materially sometimes.
Just having thought on you, do you know awareness of self and what your choices are? Do you have to consider the next person? So if I leave this job, somebody else will come in and take my place and go through.
Oh, well, you can't really consider that in the sense of that sort of end. There's an endless chain of responsibility that leaves you. You end up tying yourself up in knots. I think one is if one thinks of others, it's sort of thinking in terms of Okay, I'm participating in something that has a an effect on directly affects others, so that I want to pull back. Whereas the fact that if you leave your job, then somebody else is going to take it, man, that's pretty normal.
Just a couple of comments. One is an important aspect of, say, right livelihood is it's not about judging other people and their livelihood.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
It's very much something, basically, these are principles, I think this is my understanding here. Principles, the Buddha is just simply laying out some five basic kind of forms of livelihood that are unskillful. And that's up for you individually to take into your life and kind of reflect, okay, well, now how am I going to work with it yourself? Other people, the nature of their intentions, I mean, what they're doing, it's just, you just have no idea, basically. And you can only look at your livelihood, what you're doing, and it's not about judging others. It's just one thought. Because the word wrong livelihood, sometimes it's almost like a heavy label.
Yeah.
Sometimes wrong livelihood.
Well, again, it's helpful to come back to the word, like right and wrong in the Eightfold Path. The word is samma, and samma is originally a musical term in the ancient Indian language. So it's more like what it's referring to in terms of right and wrong is in terms of in tune, so that it's right in tune, so that there's a different, that's a different use than absolutely right, and you can puff yourself up and look down on others because of that. And wrong is in a sense it's not in tune. So then when something's something is not in tune, then it's not going to work well with the other factors of the path. It's not going to harmonize with these other path factors and lead to its purpose, its goal. So the purpose of the path is for the alleviation of suffering and the increase of well-being. So that in order to so that use of right and wrong is not again, not in that black and white and then making judgments on oneself or others.
Just wanted to bring up the example of Temple Grandin. She's this very high-functioning autistic woman. She designs most of the slaughterhouses in the United States. She's redesigned them because she couldn't stand to watch how upset the cattle were before they were slaughtered. So she designed these slaughterhouses where they feel totally calm and relaxed, and nobody moves, or there's no people, they don't like try to get out of the way, because she couldn't stand to watching their pain.
Mm-hmm.
So
there's,
that's also a real, she
would
pain, but she's also part of the
yeah.
I saw an interview with her recently where someone asked if she would contribute to the redesign of execution facilities for capital punishment, and she said absolutely not.
That's a whole different realm. Just because, yeah, again, it's sort of just because it's killing. There's different degrees of killing.
Well, I read that to an interview, said she wouldn't do that because she wouldn't cross the species boundary.
Uh-huh.
She didn't want to be involved in killing humans, but she was okay being involved in the killing of
other
species. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She actually, I've seen a lot of her, she's actually wanted to be a vegetarian because she doesn't necessarily condone killing of animals. She couldn't for health reasons. But it's very complicated.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the, again, sense of being able to look at look at a problem and see it from different ways and recognize that there's many different elements that one has to take into account. Certainly the Buddha was, his function was not to put these grand pronouncements that are going to apply universally everywhere all the time, but giving guidelines to be able to reflect on a variety of circumstances and then personal effects and social effects and make decisions from there. Yeah, Dan.
I was just thinking, about how, in my experience, like when it comes to, there are often these kind of thorny conundrums, basically. It's like, well, what should I do?
Yeah.
And like oftentimes, I find it very difficult to actually think my way out of it. So in those cases where it really isn't clear cut, I feel like in almost most cases, it's usually just like, well, I really don't want it. Rather it be this way. I think about the renunciation aspect. But then sometimes it's really genuinely seems like kind of unclear. And I find that like the just going inside of it, feeling out the quality of the heart, like looking like is it contracted, is it open, like reflecting on different possibilities. And it seems like I feel like that's kind of like the best I can do.
Yeah, and I think that's, and it's just trying to tune into that, and then also not jumping to the conclusion that you've got the right answer just because it feels clear at that time. Because, you know, it's that, there's that wonderful George Bush impersonator who talked about the, really being able to go with the gut, sort of. That's very funny and scary.
Oh, Colbert. Was that Stephen Colbert?
I think it might have been.
I think with my gut, not with my head.
Yeah. Okay, we'll... go forward a little bit, inching forward here. But it's good. I mean, it's just stimulating discussion because I think that's the that's going to be the more useful part. Coming to another book by Prabhupada, and this is Constitution for Living. I'm not sure if we have both of these are there's PDFs online of his teachings, and he's certainly Thailand's most revered scholar and a very pure-hearted being. We've got a picture of him up in our office just because he's this cherubic look to him. It's really, really delightful. Okay, this is 1 who desires progress and success in life, be it in the field of education, occupation, or livelihood, is advised to abide by the following principles. And this is a set of teachings called the Principles of Growth. And to practice according to the teachings that guide life to prosperity and eminence, known as the Four Chakra, conditions likened to the four wheels that carry a vehicle to its destination, so that it's something that we rely on for taking us to where we want to go. And where we want to go, of course, is happiness, well-being, security, peace, all these things. And the first being choosing a suitable environment, so to choose a suitable location in which to live, study, or work, where there are people and an environment conducive to learning and betterment in life, to the pursuit of the truth, virtue, and knowledge, and the generation of goodness and prosperity. Second quality is associating with good people. To seek association or alliance with people who are learned and virtuous and who will support one's pursuit of the truth, virtue and knowledge, and one's advancement and growth in a rightful way. Third is establishing oneself rightly. To establish oneself firmly in virtue and a right way of life, to establish a clear and virtuous goal for one's life and work, and set oneself resolutely and firmly on the right path to that goal, not wavering or being negligent. And the last one is called having a good, quote-unquote, capital foundation. And one portion of this capital foundation, so economic resources, one portion of this capital foundation comprises innate qualities such as intelligence, aptitude, and a healthy body. The other is, on the basis of that foundation, knowing how to rectify or improve oneself, to seek further knowledge, to strengthen good qualities, and to train oneself in preparation for when these qualities are needed, to be ready to welcome success, to bring about welfare and happiness, and to advance to even greater heights. So that's just having as general pursuit. So those are actually four qualities that are in the discourse of the highest blessings, the Mangala Sutta, laying those kind of conditions that are kind of general principles, but they're useful to keep in mind, because you need the props. That's really helpful to have these different various supportive conditions. The next bit that I was looking at that would be useful to read is the Buddha's teachings on both the function, acquisition, use of wealth, so that through abiding by the following principles, a person can be said to know how to acquire and use wealth, that is, to be money-wise, to be a good breadwinner, and to have established, and this is a bit difficult because it's they say the gender is written quite a while ago, so that it's all sort of male gender, which I'm going to trip over it, but try to bring it into more gender neutral. So to have established themselves and use their wealth beneficially, being one who performs economic duties properly. So on the level of seeking and safeguarding wealth, as practicing according to principles that lead to immediate benefit or that aid in the attainment of basic benefit. And this is known as for Ditta Dhammagadha. And the first one being endowment of industry, that is being energetic and applying oneself to one's duties, making an honest living, a training so that one acquires skills and true knowledge, and one wisely scrutinizes their undertakings and seeks skillful means to manage and conduct the work for good results, being a kind of basic industriousness. And then the second one being endowment of protection, knowing how to protect from risk and loss of wealth and the fruits of one's labors gained through one's own honest effort. Third quality is association with good friends. One discerns which people are worth associating with and which not, and to not associate with or emulate those who would lead one downward, but associating with, studying and emulating people who are learned, worthy, capable, honorable, and endowed with qualities that are helpful to one's livelihood. And then the last quality is a balanced lifestyle, to be keeping track of one's income and expenditures and living within one's means so that one is neither deprived nor extravagant and has income left over for saving. And it's from Anguttara 4. There's actually quite a few discourses that are addressed by the Buddha directly to lay people on how to live in the world, how to deal with basic things like livelihood, resources. Any questions on that or comments? Yeah.
What's coming to mind for me is that there's likely to be vast numbers of people without access to resources for education, for training, born into poverty, born into areas of the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, the Buddha was a Buddha. He wasn't a universal monarch. That was sort of what the Buddha is doing is giving guidelines for people who are making choices and who are seeking to live a livelihood with some kind of thoughtful care, so that the Buddha is not looking at it. If there were an ideal world would be like this, and we have to make an ideal world. The Buddha said, in an ideal world, everybody would be kind and considerate and have loving kindness, and they'd be generous and compassionate, and yes, everybody would be like that. But it isn't what an ideal world is. It wasn't what any world that anybody's ever seen is like. But in terms of living in the world and you're wanting to make decisions, or you're needing to, you're looking for guidance on how to do it, then these are the standards that there's some discourses where the Buddha does talk about. Like the Aganya Sutta and there are Digha Nikaya ones where the Buddha does sort of wax lyrically about how an ideal world would be. And it's the duty of, it's actually the duty of the, say, of the government or the king or the monarch to be providing the resources for people to have education, to have health care, to have time for leisure. There's all sorts of things that the Buddha gave examples for, but the vast majority of the teachings are much more about when we ourselves have a choice, then how do we make that choice? What do we do? Okay. There's something that the Buddha said on the allotting of wealth. This is from the Digha Nikaya, Digha 3. Having acquired wealth, one knows how to allot it into four portions, according to the principles for dividing wealth, known as the four bhoga vibhaga. So, first one is one portion to be used for supporting oneself and one's dependents and for good causes. Two portions are to be used for investment. Another portion is to be put aside for future needs. So, I'm not sure how much is allotted in there for credit card use.
What is investment versus savings? What do those terms?
Well, I think with in terms of investment is in the actual running of one's livelihood.
This is not to the worker, what to do with your paycheck. It's more like if you're running a business, you take one quarter
Well, that would be, say, that would be, I think it'd be like taxes as well, you know, in the sense of, and then looking, running, in terms of, yeah, looking after, maybe it is more for running a business, but those are, and I mean, again, if you have to track it down and figure out who the Buddha was talking to, because those, again, a lot of the teachings are case specific. Yes. Yeah. Investing for one.
What do you invest in? Because all the profitable stuff is wrong.
I mean, if it's more like if you're running a business, saying instead of saying, okay, our gross receipts were $1 million, and I'm the owner, so I'm going to take like $900,000 myself.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, and actually, there is a section where the Buddha, this is from the Sikhalagovada Sutta, where the Buddha does give the duty of an employer, and sort of five duties of an employer is to. One assigns one's employees work in accordance with their strength, their sex, age, and abilities. Two, one pays them wages commensurate with their work and adequate for their livelihood. Three, one grants them fringe benefits by, for example, providing medical care in times of sickness. Four, one shares with them a portion of any special profits that may accrue. Five, one gives them appropriate holidays and time to rest. I mean, that's the time of the Buddha. And, so that, you know, thinking through these things.
Thinking about also, my sense is that in the time of the Buddha, you would have been much closer to your employees, or you would even call them your domestic servants, in a sense. You would be, if you were a wealthy person, you'd be living with the people you employed. Mm-hmm. And so those policies are what would basically make your household work well, because if your employees are dissatisfied, they can make you miserable too.
Yes.
Whereas now, sort of employees and employers don't live in this, you know, they don't live in the same place, and it's much of a you show up and work so long, you work for so long and you're gone.
Yeah.
And so there's definitely much less connection.
Well, that's the thing with so much of this. It's like, because it's just a different world. Like the economic system, the whole kind of social structures is just so different. So I think the best you can do is kind of study and get a sense for just the basic principles he's kind of aiming at.
Principles that they're extrapolating from that.
Taking that and trying to make use of it, and then deciding for yourself. This is the other thing. It's like so much of this, especially, like, I just think of just what a hairball all this, kind of thinking this through. It's like, like Monsanto, just for example, Monsanto.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. It's got a lot of dubious stuff happening. But, like, I can also understand how there might be scientists, like, because I know one of the things, that, among many things that they work on, is, like, drought-resistant crops.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just one part of what they do, and they're doing it for, you know, hoping in Africa there'll be drought-resistant crops and they'll be able to feed a lot more people.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to hire scientists and researchers to work in that kind of sector of their company, and it's like, well, they're working for Monsanto, but they're doing good things. So it's just, like, the best you can do is, like, first off, obviously, you don't have him. Pastor's not pretending he does, but we don't have the answers to give for people around these issues. And just the best you can do is just be basic, kind of communicate the basic principles, and then everybody, every single person has to work it out on their own.
Somewhere. I didn't. There's problem. Let's see.
You're supposed to rise before the employer. You're supposed to go to bed after the employer goes to sleep. Because, again, this comes back to the idea of often living with.
Taking only what's given by the employer. Doing the job well, seeking ways to improve on it. Spreading a good reputation about his employer and his business.
Which would work wonderful if your employer is doing the things that he's supposed to be doing for you.
Right. And these are obviously mutually supportive.
I mean, it's incredibly humane, just even way back when.
Well, I think that's the thing, is that recognizing that, these are mutually supportive relationships that can be cultivated or need to be cultivated, and again, that sense of taking responsibility for one's actual position. that you were just in Sri Lanka and you were talking about the person who on the Uposatha days with his employees.
That was a phenomenal situation. So he had a Lalanka water bottling. He's a water bottling company. It's quite a big company, so he's very wealthy. And on top of his kind of his office, like his maybe 2 or 3 story office, and on top of his office downtown, he's got these 2 kutis where he invites monastics to come and stay. And there's almost always 1 or 2 monks staying there. And when the monks are staying there, he'll invite you to have a meal in his home, and you go in to have the meal, and he'll have his entire company come up, and this is like 5 days a week. Every day, the entire company takes the 5 precepts, and then Mr. Sagar will ask for literally a Dhamma talk, not just a morning reflection like we give. It's 15-minute Dhamma talk that he's looking for, and then on the Uposatha days, on the full moon days, the whole company keeps the 8 precepts, and the day is off for but this is quite common that people get days off in Sri Lanka on the full moon days. But the whole company, it's actually not mandatory. But when I was there, there must have been 25 or 30 people, employees, who would kind of come upstairs kind of in the morning. They're going to take the 8 precepts, and they spend the whole day. They invite the monks. The monks who are staying there to participate, just like it's like a day long basically, where the monks will give guided meditation, give a Dhamma talk, and then they have the meal, and then another Dhamma talk, and then there's some chanting for half an hour. And then the lay people, there's a time when the monks go away for 90 minutes, and the lay people sit around and discuss the teachings for 90 minutes while the monks are away, and then we come back and there's another kind of guided meditation. It's just unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it. And Mr. Sakura, he's really respected by
his employees.
His employees, they really treat him like a kind of like a guru, but he doesn't pretend he's a guru. Yeah. They really respect him enormously.
How many employees?
I just saw the number of people who would come up and take the 8 precepts. It was about 25, and I can't imagine there's much more than that working in the place. And he says he doesn't make them keep the 8 precepts, but he does ask if somebody's going to be working there, he wants them to be keeping the 5 precepts. And so his right-hand man, it's amazing, because his right-hand man is maybe 25, 26, and he's the secretary of the whole place, and he's just he's almost like an archetype of the king's assistant, is it? In the suttas, is that the assistant of a king who, the Buddha gives an example. They're on a boat with just the king and his assistant. The king says, "I need 20 pounds of solid gold," and then the assistant will dive into the ocean, come up with 20 pounds of gold, and say, "Is this enough for you, sire?" Something like that. basically indicating like this super competent. And this kind of secretary is like that, and he's about to quit because he's going to ordain. And Mr. Sagra just totally supports that. And,
Are all the abbots of the local monasteries trying to get that assistant to their
community? Good question.
Is there a next attendant?
Good question. Probably.
I'm just going to skip over a bit and then look at the how that say that livelihood translates into what the Buddha calls an ideal, or what Prabhupada calls it, say the ideal householder. A person who can be said to have achieved success in domestic life as a good householder, who is worthy of respect and emulation, can be measured by the following gauges. Possessing the four kinds of happiness. These are the four kinds of happiness that are fitting for a householder, or that lay people should always make efforts to attain. They are briefly known, four kinds of happiness for a householder. And first one being the happiness of possessing wealth, pride, satisfaction, and security of having wealth rightfully acquired through the sweat of one's brow and the strength of one's arms, sort of one's effort. Second one is the happiness of spending wealth, the pride and satisfaction of knowing that one has used wealth rightfully gained for the support of oneself, one's family, and one's dependents, and for good causes. The third one is the happiness of freedom from debt, the pride and satisfaction of knowing that one is free, not indebted to anybody. The last quality is the happiness of blameless conduct, the pride and satisfaction of knowing that one has acted honestly, faultlessly, and blamelessly in body, speech, and mind. And of these four kinds of happiness, the last is said to be the most valuable. That's the Anguttara Nikaya.